Hello and welcome to another Linguistics Career Cast, the podcast devoted to exploring careers for linguists outside academia. I'm your host, Laurel Sutton. Jyoti Iyer earned her PhD in linguistics from the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Since then, she's made the journey from theoretical linguistics to expertise in customer-facing language experiences. She's currently employed as a conversation designer, working at the interface between customer-focused experience design and enterprise AI, and focused on LLM-powered chat, the guardrails, analytics and metrics, and API integrations. She's also an LCL alum. Topics discussed include theoretical linguistics, teaching, semantics, conversation design, networking, human-computer interaction, and LLMs. Links to Jyoti's LinkedIn profile and other resources are in the show notes. Today, we have a very special guest, and that's Jyoti Iyer, who is someone I have known. I'm putting that in quotes because I've never met you in person, but you've been part of the LCL for a long time. And that's partly why I'm so excited to talk with you, because you did it and you went out there and you now have a career to talk about. So first, thanks for being on the podcast. I think people are going to be really interested in your story.
That's awesome. Thanks, Laurel. I'm really excited to be here. So much of this journey that I've gone through has been shaped by LCL. And it's really nice to get this feeling of, being able to kind of go to the field and report back.
Yeah,
exciting.
Yeah, it's awesome. So the first question I always ask people, because the answers are so interesting, is how did you learn about linguistics and decide that that was what you wanted to do?
Oh, this one. okay. So I think like a lot of linguists, I was in a bachelor's program for English. I feel like a lot of my linguist colleagues, and I had never heard of linguistics. And I was told by a very lovely professor I had in my undergrad that I may like this subject. And I was like, what is it? And that's kind of where it started. And I remember distinctly, this was 2009, I guess, buying a Teach Yourself Linguistics book.
That's great.
And she was right. I kind of dug it from the beginning. It sounded right up my alley. And I think so at that point, it led to actually writing an entrance exam for a master's program, because that's how you got into those programs, at least then. It turned into just a lifelong engagement with, honestly, something. I mean, I say lifelong because I feel like there was already engagement with linguistics before. I just didn't know what it was called.
Yeah. A lot of people say that, and it was the same for me too. I found the language part of the English studying to be so much more interesting than the literature part. You know, the languages, that's where the interesting stuff is happening. Mm-hmm. So in your school, they had a linguistics program, correct? Like for the master's anyway, but did they have one for undergraduate as well?
No, so we're talking about India, and there may have been one linguistics program in the country, or maybe two. There certainly are some now, but even now there aren't really programs that offer linguistics at the bachelor's level. So it was, at least at the time, very much a postgraduate sort of thing you studied.
And then when you decided you wanted to go on to the PhD, were you thinking you might do it in India, or were you just thinking, I should probably go to the US to do this?
That's interesting. You know, every time I look back at that moment of making the decisions, I feel slightly differently. So the story changes. But I think there was a lot of back and forth over, whether I should stay. I was at JNU in Delhi. And I had a very excellent advisor, Aisha Kidwai, and it would have, I think, been a very interesting journey and like the best mentorship I could get, really, if I had stayed. But there were also advantages to moving, and especially to get a semantics training, which was at the time somewhat hard to get because there weren't that many semanticists, just in terms of, you know, where what courses you would have available and things like that. So it was difficult to figure it out. And I think I took maybe over a year, I think, to sit on that decision. And maybe it was 2 years, and went back and forth with my advisor. And, you know, we talked through it and ended up at, okay, I think it's time to go explore a new avenue. And then I got into the universities that I applied to in the US, which, you know, is also obviously part of that decision is, did it actually pan out? Mm-hmm. And then the opportunity presented itself, and, you know, there I went.
Yeah. How many did you apply to? Just curious.
I think I applied to 5. It's been a while now. Mm-hmm. 5, I think.
That's great. And then how did you decide which one out of those 5 you were really going to go for?
So that's, I distinctly remember how I decided that, and it was a kind of silly reason. I had been told that, I had been told by people who knew me, including my advisor, that there would be certain parts of the states. I had only applied to the US, and they told me there would be certain parts I would like better than others. And I had no context whatsoever to make this decision. And so it was about where I would like to live. And the decision came down to Los Angeles or Western Massachusetts. And everyone said, well, if you want to live in LA, you have to drive. And I didn't drive. And I was like, I don't think I'll be able to afford a car and do all of that. And I hated the idea of driving. I do drive now. It's not so bad, actually. but it came down to that, actually. And in fact, some of the schools I said no to, I felt like living in the middle of nowhere. I had this metric, which was, do I have to drive 3 miles to buy a toothbrush?
Yeah.
And in some of the schools, I would, in fact, have to do that. And I was, I said no to those right off the bat.
That's so interesting. And I'm really glad you shared that, because those sorts of practical considerations are usually not things that the schools will tell you about. You know, it's not supposed to be in your consideration list, right? Most advanced degrees, like PhD programs, it's all about who you're going to work with and what's the reputation of the department. And those really, truly important things, like do you drive and do you have to have a certain amount for rent, they sort of treat that like they're secondary considerations, but they shouldn't be, right? Because it's your life. You're the one who has to live there. So if you don't feel comfortable, or it takes you 3 miles just to buy a toothbrush, like, you're not going to be a happy person in that program.
Yeah, I really do think that actually all of these considerations, the place, even the weather, which you can't really do much about that, but what the place feels like, your access to friendships, how your relationships with faculty in the department pan out, all of those things, the actual interpersonal bread and butter really ends up shaping a lot of what is a very long engagement, right? Like with a place and a program, a minimum of 5 years. And for a lot of us, it ends up taking some more time or even a lot more time. And then you're in a place where you may not have intended to be, really, a geography, an isolation if you're from another country, especially. And ultimately, I really loved living in Western Massachusetts, and I'm so glad I didn't go to LA.
I'm sure other people feel the same way about that. Not to slight LA, but it's a weird place to live, I think. It, like you say, you have to drive, and the weather is its own thing. And there are a lot of natural disasters that happen there. I feel so bad for all the people who are affected by those terrible wildfires that happened earlier this year. So, it's definitely a choice. You're in this program, and so it sounds like what you wanted to study was semantics. Is that right? Or was there another focus that you really wanted to do?
I did want to study semantics, I think, from the very beginning. And some of that is, I suppose, it was shaped by what I had access to in India and what was interesting to me. Just, I guess there's some element of it is just what you're kind of drawn to subject wise. But we had the courses I had taken in India during my master's and after that a little bit were a lot of it was the S side, the syntax and some semantics. And I was quite lucky because Utpal Lahiri had just joined our department at the time, and his semantics courses kind of shaped the beginning. And then Vinita Dayal was a visiting professor for a brief period. And the fact that there were semanticists, very excellent semanticists who were, accessible at that time, and I could take their courses, I think that really sparked an interest that ultimately did lead to what I ended up doing my my thesis on.
Was there anything that you studied over the course of the time that you were getting your degree that you was surprising, like a thing that you just found and you went, oh, wow, this is so great, I want to start studying this as well?
I think there were a lot of little nuggets that I didn't end up being really, I didn't end up doing anything with, but I kind of gained in the PhD a fascination with, you know, all of the human versus animal communication stuff, which I thought I knew something about, and then I realized I didn't. And it some of it came from teaching linguistics 101. And I was like, I really found out so many things that I didn't know before. And, you know, at some point I would like to, I think this is one of those side projects. I would like to do a side project into, you know, bird communication.
Yeah. Oh, that's so cool. And I'm looking at your LinkedIn page right now as we're talking, and it looks like you worked most of the time that you were in the program, right? You have it down as you were a researcher. So can you talk about what that was and who you worked for?
So the reason that my profile says researcher is one of the pieces of advice that I actually got at LCL, which has served me very well, is that as graduate students, we, I think as a community, tend to undervalue the work we're doing. So the fact that I'm a researcher in those years is because I was working on work that ended up being my general's papers and then my prospectus and my dissertation. At the time, I was, my official employment was as a teaching assistant. So that's also listed at, at this for the same years. So what I was doing for my paycheck was I was a teaching assistant.
Wow, that's great. I think you're absolutely right that people really tend to undervalue the skills that you use every day as a graduate student, as you're doing data analysis or data gathering or whatever it is that you're doing. It's super cool. And I, for me too, when I was teaching, I learned so much from teaching just in terms of organizational skills and project management skills and working with people, because it's sort of like a job, right? Where you have all these students and you have to corral them and get what you need from them. So that in itself is a great experience that is transferable to wherever you happen to end up working. Like you're getting your people skills every time you teach.
Yeah. And you know, the teaching, you definitely learn all of those things and then some, you know, like even the public speaking aspect, just keeping track of all of those things. But, you know, in terms of the question you asked, you know, about the research, because I am trained as a theoretical linguist, this is a question that is very difficult for even a theoretical linguist to answer for themselves. Like, what is it that you do? And, and so the research aspect, I think, is so much of it is hard to pin down. You read a lot. You think. You talk to your advisor, multiple advisors about things that you're doing in coursework, you're writing papers, ideas are sort of emerging out of all these places. And a lot of it is, you know, poking at some of these ideas and seeing if the bubble bursts, you know, so a lot of dead ends and things. And unlike lab work, it's a little bit difficult to even sometimes say how many hours you spent on something and so on. So the life of a theoretical linguist, I think, while there are there's a huge volume really of transferable skills, they are somewhat harder to pin down.
Yeah. I will say, if we can just pause for a second, looking at your LinkedIn, the way you phrased the work that you did as a researcher is really good. And it does not at all speak to some of the fuzziness you were just talking about as a theoretical linguist, right? You have super concrete things here. Analyze the structure of various languages. That's very specific. Created typological models, tested the models on new data, sourced linguistic data, presented original analyses. Those sorts of really, you know, concrete skills are great. You know, that's the kind of stuff that employers are looking for, where you can put those verbs to whatever it was that you were doing: analyzed, created, tested, sourced, presented. It's all really good. So I'm just super impressed with the way you framed the work that you did, knowing that what you were doing was a lot of theoretical stuff. It's described in very, very specific terms.
Thank you. I think it took many, many iterations to get there, and a lot of help and review from a lot of people who read my, you know, early drafts of my CV that then became a resume and then turned into the LinkedIn. And I think I often actually go and edit it even now, because I think you can always not just wordsmith it to sound better, which is of course part of, you know, image building and so on. But I think also one's own understanding of what one did can evolve with time. Because the first time I put those words on my profile, I was convinced that I was posing and I hadn't actually done those things. And the more, I mean, I think it took talking to people in industry. And I mean, some of these people also said, why don't you send me your dissertation? I'm just curious. And when they saw my dissertation, they were like, oh yeah, you know, all those things, you did all these things. And I'm like, okay, so it does match. That's good. That was good.
Yeah. And your process there is absolutely the way most people need to do it. Is trying to do it yourself is really hard. You need other people to look and confirm or suggest or edit or just bring out the things that maybe you glossed over thinking, oh, well, it really wasn't that big of a deal. And then they're like, no, this is really important. You need to include that in there. As you're going through the program, you're doing all this work. Were you thinking that you would stay in academia at that point, or were you starting to look outside?
That is such a great question. You know, I ask myself this so often, and I have no idea. I really wish I could sometimes just, you know, walk back in time and see what my state of mind was at the time. And I couldn't tell you in a month of Sundays. I think I simply didn't know. And you know, I meet people now who... Well, I mean, I suppose it just varies. Sometimes I'm surprised when people who are much younger than me know exactly what they want to do. I certainly didn't know. But I think I had assumed one way or another that if I was doing a PhD, and I've certainly met a lot of people through LCL especially who felt the same, that the PhD would naturally lead into academic employment, and that was sort of the established path. Of course, what I hadn't anticipated was, one, how difficult academia would be. I mean, I don't think my master's was a cakewalk either, but I thought it would be about the same. And it turned out that the PhD was quite significantly more difficult. So, which was, you know, certainly new information that I learned during the course of doing it. But I also discovered that I didn't particularly enjoy teaching, at least not classroom teaching. I think I'm still on the fence about whether, you know, other sorts of training and teaching contexts might maybe still hold some interest for me. But the classroom teaching of that subject matter wasn't really doing anything for me.
Yeah, I feel you. I feel the same way. I do enjoy giving information to other people, but the classroom setting, for me, it was teaching the same thing over and over again. And I know that there are people who love doing that and they're really good at it and they find new things every time. And that's just not the way my brain works. And so by the third time I was TAing the same class, I was so bored. And I thought, this can't be good for this. This can't be good for the students, right? They don't want to have a TA who's really bored by the material. So, you know, not fair to them at all. So tell me, because I can't remember, how did you find out about the LCL and what made you decide to attend?
Oh my goodness. So this was just a stroke of luck. I signed up for the Linguistic Society of America newsletter, which must have meant I signed up for a membership. And I think there must have been some reason. There was a reason. I was probably applying to some jobs, and I should have anyway been an LSA member, and perhaps I was before, but at the time I wasn't a member, and I realized that I should be because I want that on my CV as membership to professional societies. So I said, okay, I better become a member. And then I either proactively or automatically got signed up to this newsletter. And then I got the ad or whatever it was at the time for LCL. And I was really looking for something at that time. I was looking for some advice or some input, anything really that was career oriented. And it just showed up in my inbox. So it was kind of a no-brainer, really.
At that time, you said you were looking for jobs. Were you looking for both academic jobs and industry jobs?
I'm trying to remember that moment. I think I was just sort of looking around. I don't think I was certainly I was not actively looking for academic jobs by that point. And I think I was at that place where I had figured out that I needed to look elsewhere, but I hadn't the faintest idea where that elsewhere would be.
So if people want to know about the first LCL that we had, the information is still up at the Linguistics Career Launch website. You can see it was a 4-week program. There was a lot of programming that went on, and it was a balance between very specific panels. And then there was a lot of networking that we built into it. So, I'm not looking for compliments here, but what was important to you about that first experience at the LCL? Like, what were the best things that you got out of it? And what could we have done better? Because we always wanted to hear that.
I'm sorry, Laurel, but you're going to get some compliments. I think I signed up really not knowing very much at all about what it would be like. And to be honest, the answer to, you know, what was the main thing I got out of it was a sense of community that I just didn't know that I was missing. And it was really a novel experience to walk into a room full of people who were perfectly happy to talk about the fact that they don't want to do academic jobs anymore, or they're not sure, or they tried and they didn't really get any traction. And all the various, diverse situations that people were in and continue to be. And just to have a space where that was possible was, I felt like suddenly the clouds had parted and like something new was there. There was a new possibility. But, you know, practically speaking, the networking, even something as seemingly insignificant as knowing who to connect to on LinkedIn, just sending off a connection request, these kinds of things can really have a butterfly effect in terms of finding an actual job. And that is what happened with me. I think the having a safe place, having a sense of community, and then really like getting some of those, it was almost like there was a checklist of small stuff that you could do right off the bat. Like, just go today, go and connect with 5 people on LinkedIn. Why not? It seemed like a doable thing to do. And a lot of that really shaped how I felt. And it felt like a little less scary. And I think that was quite important.
That's great. I'm glad that that's what you got out of it, because we were really trying to foster that. And I think that continues. You've been back to some of our alumni events and a few other things. And it's always so good to see people coming back after having been through it. And I will say my memory of you from that first LCL is that you were really committed. And these types of boot camp programs, I think you get out of it what you put into it. And I remember, like, you were there. You showed up for the classes, you showed up for the panels, you were always asking questions, you were there at the networking events. And I think that really served you well. Like, you put a lot of energy into it. And that's the way you have to approach this kind of, you know, really intense learning. And as you said, having these checklists and doing things, you have to do it, right? Nobody's going to do it for you.
Yeah, and actually, you know, that reminds me of especially the conversation design course, which again, I signed up for as part of LCL just because it sounded interesting. And I had a vague sense that I probably need some skills, and that was it. But then when I started actually attending the classes, I realized that there was a lot to be gained. And I think, you know, the thing is, it was really fun too. So I was like, oh my God, I need to do all this homework. It just felt like fun. And I think that made it, you know, I think that was probably what kind of made me feel like, okay, you know, if I need to learn some skills, I should probably try learning these ones instead of like trying to become a Python expert overnight or something.
Yeah. And so that's what you ended up doing. Those are your jobs. So can you just talk about now how you took this class that we offered in conversation design, and then you went out and you became a conversation designer. So how did that work?
So that was really a combination of, you know, all of these little bits and pieces, the insignificant little decisions like, oh, does this course sounds interesting? Let's just do it and see what happens. And I mean, it turned out that Brielle's course was just, it was very hands-on, and it was very much exactly what you needed to learn, as it turns out, to crack a conversation design interview, which I didn't know at the time, but I was amassing, you know, these skills, which would really be very directly applicable in a few months. So, you know, it was just a matter of, you know, first being introduced to conversation design, which I did not know what that was. I had never really had any need to think about. Even at that time, there were plenty of chatbots around. I had certainly chatted with bots on websites and so on. But I had never really had occasion to think about how they work, and that somebody like me maybe was involved in designing them. Mm-hmm. And so once that that door kind of opened and there was interesting stuff to learn, I think how you end up getting a job in something is, there's a lot of luck involved as well. But if you set that aside for a moment, I think it was a combination of just the interest in the skills and the subject matter, combined with, honestly, the thing that led to my first job was, you know, like I said, a very random, you just connect with someone on LinkedIn because that's just your task for the day. And I ended up just having a connection. That was it. No communication or anything. But I had just a LinkedIn connect with Greg Bennett, who worked at Salesforce at the time. Yeah. And nothing happened in the moment. I had never spoken to Greg. I didn't know him. He didn't know me, more importantly. But, you know, at some point when he was hiring a few months later, for whatever reason, I showed up on his radar. Those are the parts that I know the least about. Why did I show up on someone's radar? Unclear. But those are the actual, it's almost surprising how directly all these little things just ended up resulting in actually getting a job. But that's how it went.
That's so interesting. And If I ever do get to talk to Greg, I might ask him and see if he remembers. But I think the way you're talking about it, it seems like doing all the little things that you said, you know, the networking and working on your resume and taking these classes, it just reaches critical mass at some point. There's just a tipping point where it all becomes significant and it all becomes connected, and something's going to come out of it somewhere. And you just have to trust that it's going to help. So you got to do all those things, even though they might seem in the moment, you know, oh, it's only a little thing, but it snowballs and then it turns into a job at the end of it.
I think that's a really good way of looking at it. And I've actually been struggling to articulate this a little bit recently, because recently I have had conversations with people who are trying to make that switch from academia to industry, or are just kind of thinking about it. And now I think because we've created this network of people who know each other, I sometimes get current linguistics students sent over to me from other colleagues, like, hey, mm-hmm. talk to this person. And it has been an interesting challenge, you know, trying to explain this. And I think this is a metaphor that I'll probably borrow going forward about the snowball, because they really, all these little decisions, they all seem a little bit silly. Like, why should I put a good picture on LinkedIn? Mm-hmm. Why mm-hmm. should I bother doing? And especially when, you know, the world is on fire all the time, mm-hmm. It can seem really ridiculous to have to do these things, but I think it is very validating at the end of the day when some of these things, which honestly are, I mean, what do you have to lose, right? You might as well mm-hmm. do it. And when yeah. all of that reaches that tipping point and results in something, then suddenly it's like, oh, I'm kind of glad I did this, you know?
Yeah. And I think too, you never know what other, I would say other, like outside of linguistics that you've done that might actually be really relevant. I think this is something we talked about when we've talked about resumes with the LCL folks, is that you should always put things down on LinkedIn too. Put down your interests, put down things that you're interested in, because it might end up being relevant. And I was talking with Emily from LCL about Taylor Melton, right, who's been on this podcast, and mm-hmm. she teaches English in Asia. And one of the classes she's teaching now is about menus and words for food in English to mm-hmm. Asian students. And that's because that's just a side thing that she always liked doing, was doing restaurant reviews and exploring new restaurants. And is that linguistics? Well, not really, but it turned into linguistics because now it's the topic of a class that she's teaching. So you can't focus solely on just your linguistic skills. I think it's important to be a well-rounded person and to bring up these other things that you are passionate about or interested in, because you never know when it's going to be part of that snowball that's rolling down the hill.
Yeah. And I think really, like, what can catch someone's eye is such a funny thing, because if you're relying on your profile getting seen online, which, you know, let's be honest, that's mostly how we're going to get discovered for a job. I think it's important to kind of remember that the people who are hiring are also people and are just as subject to, just pulls of interest. And, you know, if they see something, and maybe you're, I don't know, you'd have the same hobby or something, and it doesn't really actually, it may not have anything to do with anything. But you never know what makes you stand out in a pile of resumes, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And it relates to another part of work that I know we talked about at LCL, which is that people like to hire people that they like, right? So if someone sees that you, as you said, you share a hobby, they'll think, oh, that's cool. Then we'd have something to talk about over lunch. And maybe that's just the little bit that makes them like you a little bit more than somebody else, given the same set of skills and experiences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, I'm simultaneously bolstered by thinking in that direction. And also it bothers me very much mm-hmm. because I think there's both opportunities and also cracks through which you can fall, depending on whether somebody ends up liking you or not. But I think, you know, at the end of the day, something that really does matter is just I think a sense of respect, I suppose, is the best way I can put it. If you're talking to someone and they get the sense that you care about what they're saying, and I think most people can spot a fake or two, like, you know,
yep.
And it's a muscle, I think, that sometimes works well and sometimes doesn't. And it can always be, exercised and flexed, because people want to be heard. And I think that it can be actually an asset on the job market to just keep that in mind and give whoever you're talking to that, so that they also give it to you in return. So, you know, a sense of mutual respect, I think, can go a long way.
Yeah, absolutely. Just learn how to talk to people. That's important, which is not something that we often get training in as academics, right? And I think most of us who have been through programs know that communicating with your professors and even your advisors isn't always great, right? Because they never had any training in how to talk to people, and you can't really do anything about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's quite difficult. I will say this. it is quite difficult to understand how to. I mean, also, I don't know if this is a generational thing, which it probably is, at least in part. I don't want to, for example, pick up the phone and talk to anybody, really. I certainly don't want to do it to order a pizza or something. I'd rather do it online.
Sure.
And I think a lot of us feel this way, which is why it can often be really quite challenging.
But
yes, it's something that can be learned and improved. And you know, for anyone who feels that I really can't do it, you probably can.
Yeah.
It'll just be difficult as well.
Exactly. No, those are great points. And I agree. I hate talking to people too. But you know what? Sometimes you have to. And if you're pretty good at it, it's going to make your life easier.
Yeah.
So let's talk about, so you were at Salesforce for a while and then you moved on to a different company. So how did that happen?
So I was at Salesforce doing a termed contract job. So it was a 9-month contract, and I learned a tremendous amount in that job. But I don't know if I was necessarily, you know, doing terribly well, because at the end of it, I did not get renewed. But when you go into a termed contract, you know, it could go either way. So I was already prepared for it to for that job to come to an end at 9 months. At the time, I was also completing my dissertation still, so it was quite a challenging period. I feel like it was, you know, the first job in this industry, and there was a lot of new information, and so it was a lot to kind of keep pace with it. And I had a very good set of peers there, and our team, including Greg, just everything was very welcoming about that job. And I think that really helped me learn a lot. And you know, I got a lot from that job. But anyway, it came to an end because it was supposed to come to an end. And then as far as what happened after that, I think I was searching actively for jobs for, I forget how many months it was, but it was 3 to 4 months, I think. And honestly, I can't even believe that this is what happened, but I kid you not, the second job also came from a random LinkedIn.
No, okay.
It was not even someone I knew. It was my current boss who... you know, similarly, for reasons unknown to me, was looking around for whatever he was looking around for, and my profile popped up. And in fact, I was contacted, and you know, what I was told was, we're looking for an experienced designer. And I said, well, okay, what exact, that could be anything. And I think because the company I work for right now is more of a startup scale company, very different from Salesforce. I work for a company called Rosie AI. It was, I think, something that we thought about together a little bit, like what does an experienced designer do? What is it that the company was looking for and what was it that I could offer? Mm-hmm. And then we kind of took it from there. But it came from just, I think, having all of my information up to date and so on LinkedIn. And after that, I think it would be remiss to leave out the element of chance. But, I think a couple of things just came together to make that happen.
That's great. So your title is the same as it was at Salesforce, so conversation design. What do you do? Like you said before, what's your job? What is it that you actually do?
Yeah. So what I do is, fundamentally what I do is I design conversational experiences, which is any situation where there is a user, a human, who has to interact with a system, any kind of system, by means of language. So for starters, that's kind of a first filter of like, I don't do visual design, for mm-hmm. example. I don't really deal with websites where there are buttons and stuff like that. If I do have to interact with that sort of situation, somebody else will do that part. What I deal in is the actions that users do by means of using their words. Now, you can use your words on, say, a phone call while interacting with a robot, basically. And those robots now are quite sophisticated because of where large language models are and so on. The technologies available are quite different from, say, you might still be interacting with a lot of systems where it's like press one for this, press two mm-hmm. for this. That's kind of just an early version of ultimately the same thing, which is you want to help the user on the phone to achieve something. So it could be, you call CVS and you want to renew your prescription. It could be you call your auto insurance company, you call Geico and you want to figure mm-hmm. out, what your bill is. So it could really be anything where you would call customer service, I suppose. Like most of these applications do tend to be customer service related, mm-hmm. not all of them, but a lot of the time they are. So, there's you could be talking to customer service over the phone or over a chat. You could be doing it over SMS too, which is just a different mm-hmm. type of chat. So mm-hmm. any of those places where there are these interactions, which actually a term that I don't see very much anymore, but I think is the kind of older canonical term for it is HCI, right? Human computer interaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Uh-huh.
So that's the kind of core of what I do.
Mm. And are you on both ends of it, like taking in the data and analyzing it, or more on the production end, or like where's your place in that flow?
Okay. I wanted you to actually ask me because there are like, I want to tell you a thousand things and I'm probably going to tell you all thousand of them, but I'll start with, okay. So I think the easiest way to understand where I fit in is to kind of look at the end-to-end pipeline of mm-hmm. What these experiences involve. So, it often starts with there is a company and that company has some customer service problem. For example, they need people to make appointments. Everybody makes appointments by calling in on the phone. This takes a lot of time. Mm-hmm. It's an eminently automatable sort of thing. If you know what the appointment is for, you need some sort of calendar. And then as long as your calendar is up to date, you can automate that system somehow. A nice way to automate it is, people are already calling on the phone to talk to your front desk staff. Why not give them an AI assistant that will meet them where they already are? Mm-hmm. So, the first step of a project, certainly the kinds of projects I'm involved with right now, the first step is often, what is the problem? Figure out what the problem mm-hmm. is Sometimes the client already knows what the problem is. Sometimes they have some very, you know, just a business oriented goal. I want more revenue. I want less expenditure. Honestly, those are the business goals, right? Like the,
always. Yeah.
Those just are the goals. And so then it's a matter of, you know, distilling that down to what is a solvable problem and is it actually solvable in a conversational way? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it is and sometimes it isn't. Sometimes you have to have a different method. Sometimes it's like, oh, well, what you really need is an app. And, mm-hmm. you know, having a concierge, like an AI assistant on the phone maybe isn't the way you want to solve your problem. So, you know, this could go in any number of directions. And so, you know, understanding what the offering that the company you work at actually produces, like what is that? What are your own core competencies and how do they map onto the problem that you know, your client wants to solve? That's kind of part of it. It's always a bit of a negotiation, especially if you work at a smaller company and you're trying to both sell your product as it is, but also be flexible and try to, you know, mold it and try to, you know, make custom features and things like that, because that will help you sell it to someone who wants those features. So a lot of it is that. So I'm actually involved in even that part of the process to some degree at this point. And then it becomes a matter of like actually designing the specific flow. Like once it is determined that this is a conversation design problem, then what exactly are the situations where users would interact with whatever this system is? How do we understand the situations? Do we need to look at some user data? Do we need to talk to somebody? Do we need to talk to the front desk staff, for example, because they know why people call? And then there's, you know, you understand more what the situations are and really design flows, flow charts, really. I mean, a conversation designer's job, I think, mainly is to really map out these situations. So whether you call it a flow chart or a user journey mapping or whatever you call it, it's just a series of steps. You're really writing the conceptual algorithm of what the user does and then what the bot does. And so a lot of it is that. And then, you know, once you design that, then there are two pieces that come after. One is actually making that into something that functions, which mm-hmm. means you, in this example, you know, if you're designing some sort of assistant for an AI assistant for the phone to take appointments, what is that calendar that's going to be used? How does the mm-hmm. calendar connect to the AI? So you have to work with developers, people who write the code, various different types of people who will help you. And, you know, you'll help each other really bring that idea into some sort of reality that then can potentially be deployed into the actual world with actual customers. And only after all that does the analytics piece come in, which is this actually doing what it's supposed mm-hmm, to do? Mm-hmm. You know, is this any good? Did we just make something that's really bad, or does it work at all? You know, so
that's great. And thank you for being so very specific in going through it, because I think that's what linguists need to know, right? If you are thinking that this is something you want to do, you need to know that it's a process and there are lots of ways that you could be in it. And you probably, you know, for your own sake, you probably want to be able to jump in wherever you're needed. The other thing that you said, which I think is super important, is that obviously you're working with a team of people, right? You're not just working on your own. And those people might be other linguists who are on your team, or they might be the UX people who are doing the buttons and whatever else. So for some folks, that's a big change from when you're in academia, right? And you're sort of working all alone on your dissertation and you're not on a team. Being able to work on a team, like we talked about before, with being able to talk to people, mm-hmm. you got to talk to the people on your team too, so that you're all working toward the same goal.
Yes, I think this was something that it definitely took me a while to understand this too. It was a few months of really being very hands-on until it clicked for me that the conversation designer's job is actually, like most jobs in tech, as I'm now realizing, they're kind of inherently collaborative, because you can't really do, so even let's say you're setting up a website from scratch, you can't really do that without having all those components. Somebody's got to be in charge of, okay, where do we host the website? Somebody's in charge of what colors are on the website and like what do those buttons and so on look like. Somebody else is in charge of writing the copy. What are the actual words that will sit in all the placeholders on the website? Somebody else is in charge of, okay, if somebody does, say, fill out a form on a website, where does that data go? Like someone else is making the spreadsheet. And so it's interesting actually to see the insides of a lot of these things that we actually interact with on a daily basis, to understand what the inside of the, those machines really looks like has been quite interesting for me.
Oh, that's great. So the in the job you have now, you're doing this conversation design, and obviously, as everyone knows, people are trying to put AI into everything that exists. Do you see your role changing over time? Is there something that you want to focus more on, or are you cool just kind of doing what you're doing for the moment?
That's a great question that honestly, I'm realizing I haven't really asked myself with any seriousness recently. So you're forcing me to ask myself, which is probably a good thing. I don't know. So maybe I can break this down. Like, am I enjoying what I'm doing right now? Broadly, I would say yes. It's interesting. It's challenging. I think like any job, sometimes it's there's a lot happening and I'm really stressed out. But I think that's going to be the case in any job. And then sometimes there are downtimes where I'm like, what am I even doing today? And it tends to vary, you know, from day to day or from month to month. But as far as, you know, the actual problems we're trying to solve and so on, I think the what appeals to me actually is just a sense of order. So I like the fact that, you know, there's something the user wants to do. And then at the end of the day, when the experience is designed, then they can do that thing. That appeals to me. So I think as long as I'm you know, at least as far as my job goes, you know, as long as that's broadly the shape of the problems I'm solving, I think I'll be okay.
That's awesome. And who knows, right? You're in a in an industry right now where nobody's really sure what's going to happen next, because there's an awful lot of hype around AI at the moment. And obviously people like, well, Sam Altman, in my opinion, just is making stuff up half the time and saying, oh, it's going to do this, it's going to do that. But linguists like you,
like
I think
the AI.
You know, you have a pretty firm idea about what AI can and cannot do in terms of language models. But still, you don't know what could happen. And it seems to me that in AI, no matter what happens, there's going to be a place for linguists, people who understand language, because that's what AI is, right? It's all about the language and how it's being parsed and how it's being produced, generative AI anyway. So for folks who are listening, who are in linguistics programs and think they're interested, this is definitely a place where there will continue to be jobs no matter what happens with the AI bubble, I think anyway.
I think so. I think one of, well, okay. So for starters, I think what you said about there generally being jobs, I think is true compared to maybe some other fields. I mean, where I really don't know, you know, how much I can say on this is really, there are so many other things happening all the time. Like, I think it really is like one of the realities of being in any industry, but especially in the tech industry in the last few years, is you keep hearing about the large scale layoffs and things. So I honestly don't have a very good sense of just the number of jobs, for example. Like, I want to see that data, you know, being, you know, coming from academia, especially, I really am curious about how many jobs are there. And then we can get a handle on how many we'd be qualified for and things like that. So it is a little bit of a black box in that way. And I think it's okay to kind of be open about that, because you still have to kind of do what you need to do to build up your professional profile and so on, because you're going to have to look for a job regardless. And so if you try, that is the main way you access this information too, you know, just by trying it out and see how far you get.
Yeah. And, you know, your comment there, so much is happening, and especially right now. So we're recording this in the spring of 2025, and nobody knows what's going to happen with the economy and with funding, because the current administration here in the United States has been cutting so much funding, which affects academia, but industry also. And nobody knows. It's very uncertain time, and that could change, or it might be chaotic for the next 2 years. You know, you just can't say what's going to happen. But as you also said, people need to have jobs. So you got to focus on what you can do right now to get yourself something. And it might be short term, just so that you can have a job. The what you were saying about the number of jobs, that the information about academic jobs is pretty well known at this point. So while we might not know about industry jobs, we can say pretty definitively that the number of academic jobs for linguists, either with master's or PhDs, is small and shrinking every year. It's never going to get bigger than it is right now, which is really unfortunate, but it is the truth.
Yeah, it's funny, actually. Compared to the academic landscape, I think it's probably better.
I think so too. It's just there's more everywhere. I want to ask you one more question, and maybe this isn't even important, but at any point after you finished your PhD, did you think about going back to India, or were you committed to staying in the US?
I think about going to India all the time, actually. My parents live in India, and how do I even say this? I feel like I think about going back to India all the time. And that was true when I started my PhD program, and it's still true. And I think some of these decisions get made for just general life reasons. I live in Canada now, which is entirely because my personal journey happened to take me there. It has nothing to do with my professional life, as it turns out. I was never expecting to end up living in Canada, but that's where I ended up. And I think in the future, I don't think any of the doors are closed. And that is really important to me. I like the idea of, you know, at some point, maybe living in India again. And I guess we don't know. There are any number of things that may influence that decision. But it's nice to know that that's an option.
Yeah. Oh, that's great. That's a perfect answer. So, Jyoti, this has been so fun, and I'm so glad we got to talk. Thank you for doing this deep dive on the conversation design, because I think a lot of linguists who are listening are going to be very interested in this. If people want to contact you, is it okay if I share your LinkedIn profile on the show notes?
You actually took the words right out of my mouth. Yes. So please do share whatever contact information you'd like. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I just hope that, you know, even if one person hears it and it helps them in any little way, I'll be happy. So absolutely, if anyone wants to talk to me, I really don't know how much I'll be, but, you know, I'm always happy to try.
Oh, that's great. Thank you so much for chatting with me today. This has been awesome.
Thanks very much.
Linguistics Career Launch is an ongoing nonprofit project currently led by volunteers that works to educate students, faculty, administrators, and industry employers about the value of linguists in business, government, nonprofit, and tech. The LCL has held two online boot camps during which attendees were able to learn from and interact with career linguists, as well as gain practical experience in career management skills. V Videos of all our recorded sessions are available on our YouTube channel. You can get in touch at linguisticscareerlaunch@gmail.com.